person of color in Victorian Scotland. Worse than being one in modern Vancouver, I presume. And even that's not always easy, as I know from friends. How does the outside world treat him? How did Katrina treat him? I need to bear that in mind. If he seems cool or distant, there may be a reason. Right now, though, he's relaxed, drawn into a topic that clearly interests him. I continue. If the science is that old, why don't we already know all this? We've had 500 years to figure it out. That smile quirks again.
Perhaps we do know it, just not in this corner of the globe. Or perhaps the need for it in this corner is relatively recent, as our judicial court system develops.
Or as the lawyers get better at their jobs, and police need to work harder to make their case. His laugh is sudden and sharp.
True enough.
I flip through the notebook. So this is for police work. Observations on weapon marks.
Among other things. No, if you could please make note of the damage under his fingernails.
I lean forward to peer at dark bruises where the nails have separated from the beds.
I wince.
He was tortured.
Tortured?
At his tone, I pull back. I mean, it is possible someone did that to him. Perhaps as a method of extracting information, by putting something under his nails? It would be very painful. I believe I have heard something like that. Somewhere.
I am aware of your background, Katrina. My sister told me the full story. I understand that you may, in your felonious circles, have encountered such a thing, so there is no need to dissemble.
Felonious circles? Well, well. You do have an interesting past, Katrina. I nod, gaze lowered. Yes, sir. Well then, may I speculate that this poor lad was tortured?
You may, particularly as that would explain this. He pries open the victim's mouth to show a missing tooth, the gum still raw. The doctor performing the autopsy speculated that it had been knocked out in a blow, that I see no evidence of a head injury. Extraction seems most likely. I have heard of that being used in torture during times of war, but did not make the connection. Thank you, Katrina. Now, if the tooth was extracted, some tool must have been used. Let us take a closer look at the gums for signs of that.
And so he continues, quite merrily examining the victim and theorizing on how the tooth may have been removed. I take notes, make appropriate noises, and send up yet more apologies to poor Katrina, who is about to return and discover that not only is she expected to be able to read and write, but to listen to her employer speculate on methods of torture without batting an eye. "You shall need to convey all this to Detective MacReady," I say, when he finishes examining the mouth and hands. "It is vital information in solving the crime."
"Is it?" "I'm not certain about that, Katrina. We do not know what was used to torture the poor lad, and so this cannot help Detective MacReady."
"It helps because it proves this isn't a random victim," I say. "His killer wanted information from him." Gray frowns at me.
"What's that?"
I hesitate, then I plow forward. In for a penny, in for a pound. "There are two reasons to torture a person. One is sadism. The torturer enjoys inflicting pain. Two is the, well, practical purpose, extracting information. This particular type of torture suggests the latter. The killer only damaged three fingernails and took one tooth. I probably shouldn't say only. They are still terrible things to do. But the point is that he did not do more, which would argue against sadism as the motive."
And now Gray is openly gaping at me.
"It makes sense, doesn't it?"
"It does."
"What was that term you used?"
"Sadism." "Related to the Marquis de Sade, I presume." I shrug. Never heard of him. The point is simply that this is torture for the purpose of extracting information, rather than extracting pleasure, either for the torturer or... I cough. The point is that this is not a random murder.
In which case, the staging could be more significant than I presumed. I thought it was simply for shock, to garner attention.
Could be, I say. Probably is. What Detective MacReady needs to know is that the victim had something his killer wanted. That's significant.
It is. Excellent work, Katrina.
No. A clock rings the hour, and he curses under his breath. If you need a little more of my time, sir, I can spare it.
Unfortunately, no. There is some place I need to be. The police are addressing the media regarding this.
A press conference?
He doesn't miss a beat at the modern phrase, just waves his hand dismissively. Some newfangled idea from the commissioner. Personally, I fear it does more harm than good. But, sadly, the police are not subject to the Hippocratic Oath. I snort a laugh at that, which has him turning, brows knitting, only for him to remember what he's doing, putting away his tools.
On second thought, he says, you should come along, Katrina, if you are heading that way. Tell Detective MacReady your theory.
I think it'll hold more weight coming from you. He frowns at me.
But it is your theory.
Having worked in several environments where men were quick to take credit for my theories, or restate them right after I did and win the credit, I find Gray's genuine confusion refreshing, especially given the time period. If he doesn't understand why a doctor's word would carry more weight than a housemaid's, I won't tell him. While I suspect it's less a sign of enlightened thought than the obliviousness of privilege, I still grant him a point for it. And as eager as I am to get back to my world, I am curious about a Victorian crime press conference.
I shall join you, sir, if that is all right, but I believe the theory should come from you. You are the professional.
I suppose. I will tell him without taking credit. If the lead helps his investigation, then I will let him know that it was your idea.
Chapter 9. Once Gray is finished putting away his tools, he grabs his jacket, a double-breasted frock coat that falls just past his hips. When he dons a hat, it's an honest-to-goodness silk top hat. It looks remarkably good on him, and not at all as if he's going to whip it off and pull out a rabbit. As he strides toward the door, I say, "Are we not going to wash our hands, sir?" He looks at me and then examines his hands. They seem clean enough.
"You were just handling a decomposing corpse."
I peer at him with a dawning suspicion.
"If I say germ theory, what do you hear?"
He frowns.
"A new theory from Germany?"
At my expression, his eyes glitter.
"I am teasing, Katrina. I am well versed in contagion theory, as well as the arguments of those who prefer miasmic theory. I lean heavily towards the former. I am quite fascinated by the work of Dr. Pasteur. There is also a new theory from Dr. Lister in Glasgow regarding the use of carbolic acid. I have even read older theories on the possibility of contracting illness through touch, particularly a fascinating account from a doctor in 6th century India. I tried bringing it to the attention of my medical colleagues, but they called it foreign nonsense." He strides to the small water closet, which contains a wash basin. "We probably ought to scrub up. The smell can be repellent, and I do try to remember to wash my hands after handling bodies, in case there is any possibility of contamination." He motions for me to go first. As I scrub, he says, "When I was a medical student, my classmates would fairly clamor for the privilege of wearing the apron of a retired surgeon.
It had never been washed and was quite stiff with blood and other bodily fluids. They thought that proof of his long and storied career, but I always found it horrific, repulsive, and utterly terrifying. I was going to say somewhat unwholesome. My kingdom for a bottle of hand sanitizer. I dry my hands and turn to him. While you wash, I shall need to fetch my boots. He frowns at the ones on my feet.
Are you not wearing them?
These are my indoor boots. When his frown only deepens, I stifle a sigh. I suppose they will do. However, I do require a coat.
Ah. He lifts a hand. That I can remedy.
He finishes scrubbing and drying his hands, strides into a side room, rummages in a wardrobe, and pulls out, oh my God, it's a Sherlock Holmes coat. Lightweight tweed with a cape around the shoulders and upper arms. It's gorgeously tailored, which I'm beginning to realize just means a normal piece of middle-class clothing in a world where most is still handmade. I'm reaching for it when I pause. That didn't come from a client, did it? I ask.
Client?
Of the non-living variety?
A moment's pause. Then a half-snorted laugh. No, it did not.
This belonged to my apprentice, the one who left. Will he mind me borrowing it?
Oh, I'm quite certain he has no intention of returning. It was rather an abrupt leave-taking.
May I ask what happened? I ask as I pull on the coat.
A most puzzling thing, really. I'd obtained a cadaver from the Royal College, perfectly legal, all the appropriate paperwork and such. I wanted to test the marks made by various weapons.
Weapons?
Axes, in particular.
I see. Gray opens the front door for me and ushers me out. Scotland had 2 axe murders within a month, which got me thinking it would be advantageous to be able to compare wound patterns. There are many sorts of axes, particularly in the countryside.
Uh-huh.
I asked James to hold the body down while I wielded the axe. The first blow was rather messy. It had to be a fresh cadaver, you see. Decomposing tissues would have reacted in an entirely different way. Also, in my zeal, I may have severed the cadaver's arm, which may have shot up and struck James.
Uh-huh.
We've moved onto the street, and Gray continues talking in a conversational tone, causing 2 well-dressed ladies to quickly gather their skirts and cross the road.
I'm guessing that's when he quit? I say.
Quite abruptly.
Probably for the best.
It seems he lacked a proper appreciation of science. Gray nods mournfully.
I fear so. It will be devilishly hard to replace him.
I am certain you'll manage, sir. Though, if I might offer some advice, perhaps the first step in your hiring process should be to hold the interview while you are examining a body. Ask for their help. If they flee, you have your answer.
That is a fine idea, Katrina.
You're most welcome, sir. Nan lives outside Edinburgh, which means that while I've spent time in the city, I don't know it as well as I might if she'd actually lived here. It's like when I grew up in a suburb of Vancouver. I knew the city well enough, but my experience was limited to the areas we visited regularly. Here, I know that the spot where I came through is in the Grass Market, which is in the old town, and I know that Gray's townhouse is in the new town, but I have no clue how to find my way from one point to the other. My main point of reference in Edinburgh has always been the castle. Yep, kind of hard to miss a big castle on a hill. It's like the CN Tower in Toronto. No matter where I am, I can orient myself according to that. As we walk, I spot the top of another landmark, the monument to Sir Walter Scott. I've climbed the 200-odd steps inside, and while it's not quite the CN Tower, I should be able to see it from many parts of the city.
Gray lives in the New Town. That's the new part of Edinburgh, or it's new in this time period. Edinburgh, being a royal city, was also a walled city, and while that's great for protection, it's horrible for expansion. Behind its walls, the city grew crowded, and it grew upward. Sometime in the Victorian period, before now, obviously, those with money abandoned the old town and built the new town across the mound. As we walk, I can see the old town rising on a slope, blanketed by the smog of coal smoke that earned Edinburgh the nickname of Old Reeky. As we round the corner, I make note of the street name. When I'm back in my time, I want to see whether Gray's house still exists. Robert Street. It's a short road, with only maybe a dozen or so townhouses. There's a park to our right. Queen Street Gardens? After a quick walk, we reach a road I definitely recognize. Prince's Street. In the modern world, it's a massive thoroughfare. It's the same here, wide enough for 5 coaches to pass. Busy, too, and lined with shops and hotels. I try not to gape as I look around, taking it all in. I also need to watch where I'm walking, preferably at the side of the road away from the mud that I'm sure is 50% horse dung. I do look as much as I can, though, taking brief note of the fashions. There are other men in top hats and frock coats like Gray. The genteel women wear skirts more bell-shaped than my own. And is that a bustle? Are they coming into fashion or leaving it? Leaving it, I hope, with a shudder. We make our way to Prince's Street Gardens and cross to the old town. It is only as we walk that I realize another advantage to going with Gray. It's my first look at the city in this time period, and it gives me time to orient myself. Not just to the landscape, but to the customs of the time. I can't afford to call attention to myself before I escape back to my own world. It's a brisk and overcast day, yet still a fine walk. One I will commit to memory for the sheer novelty of it. Like strolling through the most elaborate period theme park ever. We've left the townhouses and wide streets of the new town and entered the densely packed tenements and narrow cobbled roads of the old town. Now walking gets tougher as we head uphill. At one point, when I stop to adjust my boot, Gray asks whether I'm all right with the walk. I say I am. He has a groom and presumably horses and a carriage, but he seems to prefer walking. Normally, I would appreciate that, but... Oh, let's not mince words. I don't mind the uphill walk, but streets are filthy. At least in the new town, the mud and the animal byproducts had been in the wide streets. Here, the narrow roads mean I'm walking in it, and I'm pretty sure not all those byproducts are animal. While the cobblestones help, there are still unavoidable patches of muck and some very questionable puddles. I stare down at my shit-spattered boots and try not to whimper. My indoor boots. My lovely, formerly clean indoor boots. I glance down at Gray's, which might be even dirtier, as he isn't darting about to avoid the worst of the muck. Of course not. He has a maid to clean his boots. As we walk, I'm aware that I seem to be drawing some attention. Or, I should say, Katrina is. Understandably. She's young and fair-haired and winsome, as they might say in this time. Yet I realize those looks linger less on her pretty face than her stylish jacket. Stylish men's jacket. I pull it tighter. It is a lovely coat. I find myself wishing I could sneak it back to the 21st century. I'm not the only one attracting attention. Gray gets his share, complete with uneasy glances and careful sidesteps. He is a forbidding figure, taller than most, his workman's build not quite disguised by his gentleman's clothing. Yet again, I think it's more than that, as I take a closer look at him and suppress a chuckle. "Sir?" I whisper. He glances over and I motion to his collar, which is half tucked in. He fixes that with a grunt of annoyance. Next, I gesture to his misbuttoned coat. As he does it up, I whisper, "Might
Want to go one higher?
And point at the blood speckling his shirt front. A put-upon sigh, as if I'm unreasonably insisting he use the right fork at a picnic. Even after he looks more presentable, he continues drawing those uneasy glances and careful sidesteps, and I remember my earlier thoughts about how his experiences here might differ as a person of color. When I look around, I see an Asian couple selling from a battered street cart. Otherwise, the only people of color I recall were back in the new town, and not residents, but staff. A black coach driver and an East Asian butler opening a door for a matron. That is the true difference, then. There are people of color, but I'd guess most are in service or working menial jobs. They are not doctors or undertakers, and not imposing and confident men wearing a gentleman's attire. That is what makes people uneasy. Gray has stepped out from the box in which they'd like to keep him. Not that different from home, really. We find MacReady's police station. I presume the city has a main station and that this is not it. I had the impression that Old Town in this period was tenements and slums. My impression was wrong. The station is in a working-class neighborhood, surrounded by shops and services. I don't recognize it, but without specific landmarks, there's not much of Edinburgh I will recognize here. Gray escorts me through a side door of the police station, bypassing the front desk. We go up a flight of stairs to what looks like courtroom space. Huh, that's interesting. Before I can look around, Gray steers me into the first room. I glance at the sparse gathering and whisper, "Are we early?" He checks his pocket watch and shakes his head. "Scarcely on time. It will begin any moment." I frown at the half dozen reporters surrounding us. Only three even have notepads at the ready. Wouldn't a case like this garner more attention? Maybe people in Victorian Scotland weren't all that interested in murder. As I look around, I get looks back. Looks of confusion paired with frowns. I realize I'm the only woman there and edge closer to Gray. In explanation. Why, yes, I am here with this distinguished gentleman. A pretty bauble for his arm. Pay me no heed, good sir. When Gray murmurs something to me, I glance to see a gray-haired man stride through the door. He's joined by a florid-faced man of perhaps 40, who lifts his chin with a pompous semi-smirk. Both ascend the rough platform.
"Where is Detective MacReady?" I ask,
rising on my toes to scan the front of the crowd. Gray only makes a noise deep in his throat, a near growl of discontent. Before I can ask what's wrong, the older man begins. He's a lousy public speaker, a senior officer who's been handed this position for his seniority rather than his leadership skill. He stumbles through opening remarks and then introduces the criminal officer in charge of the case, the guy standing beside him. I rise on my toes, and Gray bends to let me whisper in his ear.
"Has Detective MacReady been removed from the investigation?"
"No," he murmurs in my ear. "He is only being deprived of the recognition for it." When I frown, he says, "They have put a more senior officer in charge. Detective MacReady will answer to him, but Detective MacReady will do the work." Huh. Some things don't change, apparently. The two men on the podium do a bang-up job of making a fascinating case seem dull as dishwater, so I focus my attention on someone a little more interesting. Gray. I watch his reactions as the men speak, his tight face as he listens, his cheek tick of annoyance when the other criminal officer boasts that he'll find the killer, his full body stiffening when that officer brags about all the information he personally gleaned from the body, all the information Gray and MacReady provided. Otherwise, it's a routine press conference. The criminal officer and his superior talk about the case. The reporters ask questions. We're walking out when someone taps Gray's shoulder, and we both turn to see MacReady,
as nattily dressed as he'd been last night, smiling with an ease only barely betrayed by a tension in his eyes.
I had hoped to see you up there, Gray says.
MacReady shrugs.
Someday. That man is an incompetent bore. He solved one case 20 years ago, and he's skated on his reputation ever since.
It wasn't one case, Duncan, MacReady says, as he steers his friend to the side.
Yes, it was. 3 consecutive murders, but only a single investigation. That makes it one case.
A serial killing? I say.
Gray frowns at me.
Serial?
Yes. I suppose that's what one would call it.
Katrina? MacReady says, as if just seeing me there.
Whatever are you doing here?
And what are you wearing?
A fine gentleman's jacket, I say. Is it not stylish?
I twirl, and one corner of his mouth rises.
It was, about 5 years ago. But I dare say it looks better on you than it did on young James.
It's a bold fashion statement. I approve. I half curtsy.
Thank you, kind sir.
His look is half amused, half bewildered. Apparently I'm not acting like the Katrina he knows. He gives his head a shake and says,
As for the original question, what are you doing here with Duncan?
She was helping with my laboratory observations, Gray says. I dare say she did a sight better than James. Perhaps it's not only his coat she shall take over. I expect MacReady to laugh, but something in his face tightens. Gray continues.
Katrina made a few astute observations of her own.
Did she? And our young Katrina evidenced a never-before-seen interest in your work, I presume.
It is very interesting, I say. I did not realize so until now.
MacReady's tone chills.
I see.
We head outside. The two men talk for a few minutes, and I'm looking around, ready to take my leave, when MacReady says,
Katrina?
I glance up to see it's just the two of us. I peer around for Gray.
I sent Duncan to fetch us pies from the cellar, he says. I wanted a word with you.
He motions me around a corner, and I'm about to say we should tell Gray where we've gone, when I realize that's the point.
Yes, sir?
I say after I've followed him.
So, you've discovered a sudden interest in Duncan's scientific inquiries.
As I said, they are interesting. His face hardens.
Do not take me for a fool, Katrina, and do not forget who took you to Isla. I believed you could be redeemed, and you have done nothing but prove I am a very poor judge of character.
Isla? Is that Mrs. Wallace's first name?
No, Gray said his sister hired me. That must be Isla.
Wait. Redeemed?
Right. Gray did say something about Katrina's felonious past.
MacReady continues.
I cannot count how many times I have bit my tongue against telling Isla the rest of your story. The parts I misguidedly decided were not your fault. I know better now.
There was no Fagin in your life, Katrina. It is all you. The only reason you are still employed is because Isla is too good-hearted, nay, too stubborn, to accept defeat. And Duncan is too caught up in his work to see you for what you are. But I see you, and I will not allow this.
Allow what?
His eyes narrow.
I warned you not to play me for a fool, Katrina. You owe me the respect of honesty.
You did not take a sudden interest in science. You took a sudden interest in the man behind the science.
I stare up at him.
Then it hits.
You think I'm trying to seduce Dr. Gray?
I think you liked your stay in their guest room. I think it made that scheming mind of yours do what it does best.
Scheme?
Do not mock me, Katrina. You tread on very dangerous ground here. If I told Isla the rest of your story, and if Mrs. Wallace stopped shielding her from the worst of your misdeeds, you would be out on your arse. You have set your cap on Duncan. You are a pretty girl from a decent family, and Duncan is a very busy man with no time to look for a wife. You see an opening. A doctor marrying his housemaid? I want to say someone else has been reading romance novels, but then I realize it might not be so implausible. Grey isn't a lord or an earl, and from what MacReady is implying, Katrina didn't grow up in tenement housing. She's a girl from a good family who made poor choices, one who might be looking to climb back up to her old status. It will do you no good, MacReady continues. That's what I pulled you aside to say. I could warn that I am watching you, and you'd best not try anything, but I needn't bother. We both know how he is. How he is? MacReady eases back, a little of his anger dissipating. An illustrative example, Katrina, in case you have failed to notice these things on your own. Last month, we were in a public house and Duncan got into a brawl. Dr. Grey? There's honest incredulity in my voice. He did not start it, which I should say makes the man happier than is decent. He does love the excuse for a good bout of fisticuffs. In this case, he had it, having been struck with a knife. What? MacReady waves off my concern. He stitched himself up later. Again, not the point, which is that his blood cast a pattern on the wall. He began sketching it and comparing it with the wound and the angle of the blow. When a young lady evidenced great interest in what he was doing, he quite happily explained it to her, never once realizing that she was not interested at all in the blood pattern, and was rather more interested in his... He coughs. In his ability to pay for her services.
Oh. She was a sex worker.
A what?
Lady of negotiable affections?
He gives a short laugh. I suppose so. Though I have the feeling she would have negotiated a very low price for those affections. They always do for Duncan. Yet, the point is that he was oblivious. He is always oblivious to attention from the fair sex.
Because he prefers men?
MacReady's eyes round, and he sputters incomprehensibly before saying, No, he likes women. But the women he likes are not pretty shop girls or fetching pie sellers or winsome housemaids. And they are certainly not ladies of negotiable affections, as you put it. He will never notice your interest because he will not share it. And if you force him to notice it, he will find you alternate employment within the week. You have chosen your target poorly, Katrina.
Perhaps you mistake my interest, sir?
He snorts. So, you're actually interested in the science of dead bodies.
As you say, I come from a good family. While I have thus far concealed it, I do possess an education and a brain, though you obviously do not think it.
Oh, I never doubted that, Katrina.
Yes, I see an opening here, an employment opening. Dr. Grey is in need of an assistant, and as I am not squeamish, I see no reason why I should not angle for the position. Yes, that might require exaggerating my interest in the subject. It is, however, vastly more interesting than scrubbing water closet pots. He eyes me, and I can tell I have made a valid argument. I only hope Katrina thinks so when she returns.
All right, MacReady says slowly. I will not interfere with your pursuit of the position. If your pursuit turns elsewhere, though, it will not, I say, with a conviction that seems to settle his mind. He leads me back around the corner to where Grey is scouring the area. Spotting us, Grey strides over, pies in hand. What the devil were you doing back there? He asks. He seems genuinely perplexed, failing to presume the natural reason a man might take a pretty maid around a shadowy corner. MacReady is right, then. Gray does not see Katrina in that light, which is a relief. Gray hands me a pie, and then explains my torture theory about the fingernails and the missing tooth. As promised, he doesn't credit me, but neither does he take credit himself, crafting his words in a way that allows MacReady to presume it was Gray's idea, but with an opening to correct that later. I can't imagine Katrina will care who takes credit, but Gray is going out of his way to be fair-minded, and I appreciate that. When MacReady is called back into the station, Gray turns to me. Now you may begin your truncated half-day off, Katrina, which I will repay doubly.
Thank you, sir. Before I go, might I ask you an odd question?
One brow rises with interest.
Of course.
Where was I found after my attack?
Where were you found?
I wish to go there and see whether it jostles my memory. I have no recollection of the evening, and I would like to know what happened to me.
I glance toward the police precinct.
I presume there is an active investigation?
He hesitates, and as he does, dark color creeps into his cheeks. He glances toward the station, and then plucks at his necktie as if it's suddenly too tight.
No, there is not an investigation. Had you perished in the attack, there certainly would have been, but you did not, and
I am only a housemaid.
I expect him to deny it, but he says, partly that, and partly because in the area of town where you were found, such attacks happen thrice a night. Perhaps not as serious as yours, but assaults are common enough that the police do not involve themselves unless it results in murder.
Which I'm sure is a great deterrent to the area's thieves, ruffians, and rapists.
He colors more.
Yes.
As to that, you were not... Another tug at his collar. As the attending physician, I felt obligated to check for signs of tampering with
my virtue?
Yes. Had that occurred, I would have insisted on an investigation, but that did not seem to be your assailant's goal. Also, I assure you that I did only the most circumspect of inspections.
It was a medical exam, I say. It's fine.
Now, regardless of whether there's an investigation, I would like to jar my memory, if possible. I fear I was assaulted by someone familiar to me, someone I might trust.
He frowns. There was no evidence. It was anything but a random assault.
Was it? The detective in me can't help analyzing what I heard that night. The first cry had sounded like a playful squeal, as if Katrina had been surprised by someone she knew. Someone she knew well? Or a mere acquaintance? Again, not my monkey, not my circus. With any luck, Katrina will return today and be able to name the attacker herself.
Will you tell me where it happened?
I ask. I will take you there. I shake my head.
You have better things to do, sir.
I do not, at the moment. Also, as I said, it is not the neighborhood for a young woman. I insist on escorting you.
Chapter 10. Gray was not exaggerating. When he shows me where Katrina was assaulted, I can only gape and wonder what the hell a 19-year-old housemaid was doing here. As I theorized, it's the same spot where I was attacked in the modern day. Ironically, in that period, this is a picture-perfect tourist street, designed to make you feel as if you've stepped into lovely Victorian Edinburgh, when the reality is that it had been a street no Victorian tourist would set foot on. The narrow, cobbled road, quaint and cozy in the 21st century, is so dark and shadowed that it might as well be labeled Battery Boulevard.
As we walk through the neighborhood, I resist the urge to pull in my skirts like a proper little miss, my pretty nose upturned, curls flouncing. While I'd patrolled in modern tenement neighborhoods, this is worse than anything I'd seen in Vancouver. This is true squalor, with the stench to match. The kind of place that reminds me how, only hours ago, I'd acknowledged that some people would happily take Katrina's job. Now I see those people, for whom a daughter in service would be the one who got out, the pride of the family, sending home whatever shillings she could spare. Katrina wasn't from this neighborhood. So what was she doing here? The answer, apparently, can be found just a few steps from where her body was discovered. As we stand in that alley, Gray points to a hand-lettered sign on a nearby grimy window.
You were in there, having a drink.
It's a pub? He clears his throat.
It passes for such, but Hugh, Detective MacReady, says it is a known den of
iniquity? He looks startled.
No, not at all. There's nothing of a salacious nature about it. I was going to say den of thieves, and then realized my phrasing might be offensive.
Not if I used to be a thief.
Yes, but you are no longer one. So I presume you were meeting a former compatriot for a drink. A social engagement.
I look at that grimy window and try not to shudder. You'd need to pay me to drink anything served in there. All right, so I was spotted in that establishment, I say.
Spotted leaving it, he corrects. The proprietor would not confirm you had been a patron.
But I presumably was. Then I came out and was pushed into this alley here, where I was hit on the head and strangled. Or I was strangled and struck my head in falling. I drift into memories again, trying to remember exactly what I'd heard and seen. A shadowed figure throttling Katrina. She'd been conscious, so she must have hit her head when she fell. Stop that. Solving the attack on her isn't my business. Getting home is my business. My only purpose in being at this spot. I start to walk down the alley and halt. I don't want to cross through time with Gray standing right there. I owe him better than that. I stop short and wave my hand.
Do you know precisely where I fell?
He shakes his head.
You were not discovered for several hours. When you were, it was by a passing constable. He recognized you, having seen you once before with young Findlay.
Constable Findlay? Detective MacReady's assistant? I open my mouth to ask why I'd been with Findlay, but then I remember yesterday when MacReady had seemed to expect that Findlay might wish to speak to me. I'd thought it might be a romantic entanglement. They were of an age, and Findlay would be a good social match for Katrina. Gray continues.
Recognizing you, this constable sent for me, and I attended you here before bringing you home.
No one had noticed me missing.
It was one of your half days off.
So, Katrina had a half day off, and that night, instead of being home in bed, she was here, in this pub, possibly meeting an old colleague, possibly continuing her felonious ways. As a detective, I'd start there. Former, or not-so-former, thief gets attacked leaving a black market dive bar. While it's possible it was a random attack, it's more likely connected to her criminal endeavors. She pissed someone off, double-crossed someone, or even just refused a gig. That classic one more job. Of course, none of this matters to me. I'd love to solve the attack on Katrina as an apology for borrowing her body. But even if the answer miraculously fell from the sky, I doubt her attacker would ever see justice. She's only a maid. And this was only a physical assault in a neighborhood where it might happen to anyone alone at night. I suppose Katrina figured she could take care of herself. Just like the detective who ran into this alley 150 years from now, alone, at night, following the cries of a woman in distress. Seems we both aren't as street savvy as we thought. I turned to Gray.
Thank you, sir, for bringing me here. I think I shall linger and see whether any memories return.
Leave you here? He looks around in horror. Absolutely not.
It's daytime, sir. I will be fine.
In the very spot where you were brutally attacked and left for dead. No. Look around all you wish. I shall wait.
I don't let Gray wait.
Oh, I can't convince him to leave. MacReady grumbled about Gray's sister being stubborn. Apparently, it's a family trait. And when a man of Gray's size decides to park himself somewhere, he stays parked. I won't try to cross through time with him watching. So the only way for me to break the impasse is to pretend to skulk about with dramatic pauses for deep contemplation and deeper sighs before declaring, I remember nothing.
We will head back through the market, he says. I'll leave you there to do your shopping.
Shopping?
Spending some of your quarterly wages.
And what would I spend it on?
He throws up his hands.
Confits, ribbons, a new bonnet, whatever you like.
Candies and pretty bows? Is that truly where he imagines a housemaid's salary goes? In his defense, maybe he hopes it does. Katrina's daily needs are covered, food, shelter, uniform, and such, and so he expects wages to be like pocket money. If I were a maid, I know exactly what I'd do with my salary. I'd save it up, in hopes that I wouldn't be scrubbing chamber pots into my twilight years. While I don't actually have any wages to spend, I'll let Gray escort me to the market. Once he leaves me to shop, I'll sneak back to that alley. This neighborhood is known as the Grass Market because it used to be the main market for Edinburgh. It's now more of a hodgepodge of shops and tenement housing, all of which have seen better days. Hell, better centuries. But there's also an open market space with stalls, and there's where we go. I expect Gray to deposit me at the edge, but he seems quite content to wander at my side. That is, he's content to do so until a cart of antique books catches his eyes. Is that Paré's plague treatise? He murmurs to himself as he wanders off.
Thank you, sir. I call after him. I shall see my own way home this eve.
Unfortunately, the sound of my voice reminds him of my existence. Gaze still half on that book cart, he takes two long strides my way as he roots in his pocket. When he reaches me, he passes over a coin.
For your help today, Katrina.
I thought we agreed to time off instead.
You earned both.
A faint smile. Spend it on something that makes you happy. I don't even have time to thank him before he's heading back to those books, leaving me staring at his back and thinking that, of all the fascinating things in this world, he might be the one I'll most regret not getting to know better.
I'll look you up when I get home, Duncan Gray, I murmur as he bends over the cart of old books. I expect you did some amazing things.
I lift my fingers in a wave, even if he can't see it, and then I hurry from the market. I have been in the right spot for over an hour, pacing and wandering, and at one point, when the lane is clear, even dropping to the ground, as if I can somehow pass through time that way, I realize that is ridiculous, just like I realize this entire plan is ridiculous. I'm trying to pass back through time by returning to the place where I crossed over. My brain says that makes logical sense, but I am well aware that it only makes sense because I've seen it in movies and read it in books. To return to your own time, you go back to that spot, that magical bridge between worlds. Or you go there and do something you did the last time, and that makes you cross over.
Maybe it's a word or a phrase or an action or an emotion. Do that thing and it will unlock the door through time. Which is like saying that if I tap my ruby slippers 3 times, I can go home again. I am basing my entire theory on the imagination of fiction writers, not scientists, because there is no science. People can't travel through time. Therefore, writers don't need to worry about getting it right. They make up whatever they want. To return to your own time, child, you must find the spot where you crossed, during the same alignment of the planets, and then eat 150 leaves of thyme, one for each year you must travel. I knew this was a preposterous plan, yet it was the only one I had. And what was the alternative? To throw up my hands and resign myself to the life of a housemaid, when a walk across town might have been the key to returning? If so many writers used that particular trope, maybe there was a kernel of truth to it. It's like meeting a vampire while holding a vial of holy water and not throwing it at him. I don't know what happened to me. I cannot begin to understand it, because the possibility doesn't exist in any reality I know. I suspect modern theoretical scientists would have ideas, but it's not a subject I've ever needed to research. I am hoping, then, that some author or screenwriter did the research for me, and this whole return to the spot where you passed over idea is sound. What I suspect, though, is that what I encountered here was a rip in the fabric of reality. I was strangled in the same spot on the same day, at the same moment, as a young woman 150 years earlier. That caused some crossing of wires in a cosmic sense, and my consciousness, my soul, or whatever you care to call it, somehow swapped with that of Katrina Mitchell. Can such a thing be undone? I can't even contemplate a negative answer. The despair would swallow me whole, and I might find myself taking the most desperate action to get home again, to put myself in those exact conditions, to die on that spot and hope that took me home, because I cannot imagine being trapped here forever. There are worse fates than being a maid in a decent household. I have a job and food and a roof over my head. There's even the possibility that I could become the assistant to a man doing work I find fascinating. Work I could surely help with. But those are only scraps, barely enough to keep me from lying down on this spot and strangling myself. Yes, there are things in my real life I'd like to change, but I want the chance to do that. I need to see Nan and tell her all about this before she dies. Give her a glimpse into true magic. A goodbye gift. One last secret between us before she's gone. I want to make other changes too. Work less, play more, renew friendships, fall in love. Compared to Katrina, though, I had an idyllic life. A challenging job that I love. A cozy condo and a loving family and my freedom. Most of all, I had my freedom. I could go where I wanted, do what I wanted, be who I wanted. This is not my world, and I do not want to stay in it. So, I will sustain my spirits by telling myself there must be a door, that I can get back, and either I'll figure it out or I'll return when the universe repairs its glitch. Until then, I'll make the best of it. Be Katrina Mitchell. Do whatever I can to make that role mine. To be a version of this girl that I can live with and not go mad. Also, to not act in any way that'll have me labeled mad. Keep my secret, blend in, and do my best. I pace the alley one last time, as if the 1,000th will make a difference. When footsteps sound, I stiffen. I'm not alone on this lane. I've had my share of curious looks. I entertained 2 offers of companionship before I learned to busy myself whenever anyone passed. Still, it's been safe enough. However bad the neighborhood, it's still daytime, and even the offers had only been for a drink, while naturally hoping it'd lead to more. It's not as if anyone has honestly mistaken me for a sex worker. At those footsteps, though, I still steel myself as I turn. It's a woman, maybe in her late 20s, dark-haired, with a scar across her cheek, and a narrow-eyed look that dares anyone to ask her how she got it.
Well, look at the little kitty cat, slunk back to see what's left in the cream bowl. I thought you'd never show your face here again, not after last week.
I heard someone taught you a lesson. Much overdue it was.
The woman smiles, revealing exactly the sort of teeth I expected from an era before regular dental cleanings. Then I realize what she's saying. She knows me. Knows Katrina. And something else.
You know what happened to me here? I say. When I was attacked.
Everyone does. They're wagering on who done it. Too many people wanted you dead. I can't say I blame them.
She leans forward, foul breath washing over me.
If you want to make a wager yourself, we can put it under my name. Earn ourselves both a bit of money.
I shake my head.
I don't know who attacked me. I don't even remember why I was here.
I tap the fading bruise on my temple.
I've lost my memory.
She laughs so hard a rat squeaks and scurries off.
Oh, is that your story? And such pretty manners, too.
Her eyes narrow.
What are you up to?
Trying to figure out who tried to kill me.
More eye narrowing.
Do not forget who you're talking to, Miss Kitty Cat. I know all about that canny mind of yours. I've been a victim of your schemes as often as I've helped you build them. You might be able to fool the lads, but I see past that pretty face.
Before I can speak, she rocks back on her heels.
Is it the doctor?
What?
Your master, Dr. Gray. I heard he came to fetch you, nursed you back to health. Have you decided to take my advice? Is that what the pretty new speech is for? The pretty new manners? You finally set your sights on the master?
She bats her lashes and simpers.
Oh, kind sir, I don't remember anything with this lump on my skull. I am but a poor, innocent lassie in need of a strong man's protection, a strong and rich man's protection.
She cackles.
He may not be a proper toff, but he's got a fine house and a fine income. No proper lady will have him, so you might as well.
Dr. Gray's occupation would hardly prevent him from finding himself a proper lady.
His occupation? She snorts. You have indeed taken a hard blow to the head if you think that would be what stops them.
I did take a hard blow, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
Are you daft? Even if you've forgotten the scandal, surely one look at the man will jolt your memory.
She taps her cheek and arches her brows.
Does she mean because he's not white?
What would that have to do with a scandal?
Ah, I bet I know. His skin tone suggests one of his parents is white and the other isn't. Such a union would probably be shocking in this day.
Whatever the issue, I say, I cannot imagine Dr. Gray lacks for female companionship. And no, I have not changed my mind on that count. I'm not sure how traipsing around this neighborhood would help me win him to my bed.
Traipsing? My, my, you speak like a properly educated lady yourself.
She eyes me. I've heard you come from a good family, however much you denied it. That could be useful.
Get little Miss Kitty Cat into places no alley cat girls can go.
I shake my head.
I just came to see if I could find out what happened to me. If you have anything to add, I'd appreciate the information. Otherwise...
She grabs my arm, fingers digging in.
Pretty words and manners are all very fine. But don't you go putting on airs with me.
Do not forget, I know things that would get you tossed from your fine doctor's home.
Yes, I murmur under my breath. I've heard that before. Today, in fact.
She twists my arm.
Do not mutter insults at me, Katrina.
I wasn't, I say, and I apologize if I was being rude.
I pause. Perhaps we could have a drink, for old time's sake?
If this woman holds something over me, I need to be nice. Also, I'd like to know more about the young woman whose body I inhabit, and this seems an excellent opportunity to do so.
A drink? The woman scowls. Is that a joke?
Fortunately, my expression must answer for me, because she eases back, still eyeing me sharply.
You really have lost your memory.
No, kitty cat, I do not want a drink. I don't imbibe.
Neither do you.
And that piece of advice I'll give for free. Lose yourself in a bottle and soon you'll be lifting your skirts for more. That's not the life for us.
So, what is the life for us? I say. Forget the drink. And may I ask you some questions?
I take out the coin.
I can pay.
With 2 bob. That'll buy you 2 words. She makes what I presume is a rude gesture, and then puts out her hand. I pocket the coin.
How much for more?
I'll give you the going rate for a high-class whore. 1 pound will buy you 20 minutes of my time. She starts to walk away. You know where to find me, kitty cat.
No, actually I don't.
She laughs and points at the dive bar where Katrina had been spotted the night she was attacked.
Can I get your name?
I call after her. She turns and puts out her hand. With a sigh, I drop the coin into it.
Davina,
she says, closes her hand, and walks away. Chapter 11. By the time I get home, I'm starving, and I've missed dinner. I'm not even sure I'd have been entitled to it on my day off. While I doubt Gray would have begrudged me an extra meal, Mrs. Wallace is an entirely different matter. I stand in the doorway of the darkened kitchen. It's past 8, and the housekeeper has cleaned up and gone to her quarters. There's food here somewhere. Katrina wouldn't think twice about taking it, and if I want to convince them I'm Katrina, I should do the same. Yet I can't bring myself to step into the kitchen. I'm not Katrina. I don't want to be her. At first, hearing of her felonious past, I'd been intrigued and a little impressed. Not such a meek housemaid after all. A cop shouldn't be impressed by a thief, but I've always had a keen appreciation for circumstances. As a patrol officer, if I got a call for some kid in $200 running shoes swiping a candy bar, you can bet your ass I'd be speaking to her parents and writing it up. Make that a teen runaway swiping condoms so he doesn't knock up his girlfriend, and I'd point him to the nearest Planned Parenthood and persuade the shop owner not to lay charges. I do not judge lives that have seen the kind of hardship I struggle to comprehend. I was raised in an upper-middle-class family, the only child of a tenured professor and a law firm partner. My parents made damn sure I understood just how much privilege I had, whether it was weekends on the farm or weeknights in a soup kitchen. I'd imagined Katrina was a girl who'd grown up fighting for scraps, a victim of circumstance, who'd done what she had to and worked up to housemaid in a prosperous home owned by a decent man. It might not seem like much to me, but it was a Victorian success story. Except that's not how it went at all, was it? Katrina didn't grow up in old town poverty. That doesn't mean she didn't escape horrors of another kind at home. But I'm getting the sense she's less a scrappy success story than a remorseless criminal. Maybe there's more to her. Maybe, even if there isn't, I can't completely blame her, given the restrictions she faces in this world. But I know one thing. I don't want to be her.
If I'm temporarily stuck here, then I will become Katrina version 2. Gray mentioned that brain damage can cause personality shifts. I remember the case of Phineas Gage from Psych 101. The guy got a railroad spike through his head, and it completely changed his personality. While I think that kind of shift only occurs with actual damage to the brain, if Gray, as a doctor, doesn't know better, I should take full advantage. Yep, a blow to the head changed my personality. It made me, apparently, better spoken and better mannered, which would be hilarious to anyone who knows me. I might come from privilege, but I've always been what one might call a little rough around the edges. More of a beer and nachos, jeans and sneakers, rough and tumble kind of girl. Ironically, compared to Katrina, I am the sweet-tempered housemaid I expected her to be. I can make adjustments, though, closer to the real me. Katrina clearly had an edge, and therefore so can I. She had a brain, and she had an attitude, and she had a healthy dose of self-confidence. Therefore, I do not need to rein in that side of myself as much. As Katrina version 2, do I want to steal from the larder? No. Or, that's a fine excuse. The truth is that as I stand in the kitchen doorway, the despair from earlier rushes back. I think of my apartment, where the only question would be whether there's anything I want to eat in the fridge. I never even had to sneak cookies as a child. My parents kept a shelf of kid-friendly snacks, and I was welcome to help myself. Nan had fruit on the counter and the ever-present biscuit tin. Even my dad's parents, as strict as they were, bought little boxes of raisins and animal crackers for my visits, long after I passed the age for either. Access to food. It's a silly thing that looms huge right now. A symbol of what I had and what I face. A life where if I miss dinner, I go hungry until breakfast. A life where there aren't coins in my pocket to slip out and buy something to eat. A life where I'm not allowed to just slip out. And even if I did, I'm not sure where to find dinner, or if I'd be welcome as a young woman alone. This world may not be hell, but it is another sort of nightmare. One where my rights and freedoms have been snatched away, and I am powerless to fight back. That might be the worst of it. I want to fight, and I cannot because it would land me in the streets or an insane asylum. Be a good girl, do as you're told, don't make waves. Words so many other women grew up with, sentiments I was never taught. I don't know how to do this. I'm not sure I can. I want to go home. I just want to go home. I need to get to Nan if I can, if she's still alive. And if she's not? Were her dying hours spent frantically wondering what happened to me, and then passing without ever knowing the truth? And my parents. Oh God, my parents. They'd have been notified I was missing and would have dropped everything to fly to Edinburgh. Instead of spending Nan's final days with her, did they spend them looking for me? Were they facing the possibility of grieving us both? Am I missing? I realize with a jolt that I might not be missing at all. I might be walking around the modern world with Katrina puppeteering me. What if Katrina took over my body? A thief and a con artist in my body, with my grandmother, with my parents. She'd only need to be found wandering and confused, and someone would have taken the ID from my pocket and contacted my parents. What damage could she do? As a police officer? As the only child of doting and well-off parents? Katrina? At the voice, I spin to see Alice. When I move fast, she shrinks on herself before straightening. How many times have I seen her do this? How often have I lifted a hand and she's flinched? Moved toward her and she's steeled herself. Spun to face her and she's drawn back. Such a timid little thing, I'd thought. Scared of her own shadow.
That must be what life is like for girls her age. Not even a teenager and already in service. Yet now that I reflect on it, I realize I've heard her chattering away to Mrs. Wallace. I've seen her take coffee to Gray, her demeanor relaxed and confident. She doesn't flinch from them. Doesn't draw back from them. Just from me. No, just from Katrina.